Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Today, we're joined by Dr. Sarav Shah, an orthopedic surgeon and chief of the Division of Sports Medicine at New England Baptist Hospital, as well as the co-director of the New England Baptist Hospital Sports Medicine Fellowship and Shoulder and Elbow Fellowship. Dr. Shah, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be with you guys.
What initially drew you to orthopedic surgery and specifically to sports medicine and shoulder and elbow surgery?
I'll be honest with you. I've had a strong interest in shoulder from the get-go. And then, it was advised to me, I like sports, love sports. My residency director kind of pushed me in the direction to keep in mind that sports medicine, you're able to do more things, right? You don't want to limit yourself from the jump. So that's kind of what pushed me to do sports and shoulder. Orthopedics from the beginning, I was initially interested in hand, honestly, because my father had an unfortunate lawnmower accident that kind of pushed me towards orthopedics. And, I was the one that found the finger and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So that's what kind of drew me in that direction. But then from there, it was sports and shoulder. Once through medical school, kind of see the differences and rotate through ortho, it kind of pushed that way. After I saw the sports aspect and the shoulder aspect, it was just more fun for me.
You mentioned that you knew you wanted to do shoulder from the get-go. What is it about the shoulder that's so attractive to orthopedic surgeons?
I think that's an excellent question, and something that medical students and other residents should keep in mind and try and think about. For me, to do shoulder means I take care of everything in the shoulder. So, being sports and shoulder allows me to do anterior bank arch in an 18-year-old, but then, I'm going to do a shoulder replacement in a 75-year-old. So, the shoulder is complex. It's dainty, if you will. It's less forgiving than a knee and a hip, maybe. So, it takes a little bit more, I would say, attention to detail. And I kind of nerd out on that a little bit. So I think that's something that's alluring when there's so many facets you have to take into account. But when it's a hit, it's a home run. So, you can get back their upper extremity mobility and function is like the best feeling in the world.
Did you have a specific mentor or a clinical experience early on that really shaped your experience in your training?
Yeah, I mean, early on, it was David Dines. I'm not sure how familiar, he's an HSS shoulder upper extremity surgeon, but he was the chairman when I started intern year at North Shore LIJ, my residency, and then he kind of transitioned, away from LIJ, but I worked with him essentially for 7 years, 5 years residency. And then I did my shoulder ball fellowship at HSS, and he's the one that recruited me personally to that fellowship. So, early on from the jump, he was kind of instrumental in pushing me and kind of forcing me to be the best that I could be, which is, essential when I was 24 years old, intern year coming into residency. So it's a little bit needed when you're that young to push yourself to drive to be the best you can be. And as as a orthopedic surgeon, it takes a lot to be a good surgeon, a good researcher, but also still be present at home. And it's a lot to balance. So he was instrumental in pushing me.
I actually don't know him personally, but obviously HSS has a world-renowned faculty. And that must have been quite the experience to have him as a mentor for 7 years.
Yeah. And he holds you to a higher standard. So, that kind of pushed me to, I've always said, I'm trying to emulate him, so it always just means a little extra to have that, father figure type.
Once you hit that home run, it's like now going, getting to the next level with, if it's rehabilitation, it's working with athletic trainers, working with physical therapists. How do you as an orthopedic surgeon work with athletic trainers and PTs and sports scientists to connect and have the best care model to be able to provide for your patients?
That's a great question, because it's a delicate balance at some institutions. Most of the Baptist connections, we have a good relationships across the board, so we're able to talk easily, texting, and that's kind of the personal relationship you need to have to maintain those balances of rehab. Open line of communication, I think, is the key. I give my cell phone number to all the PTs, and they kind of text me, email me if they have any questions or anything kind of closely related to the rehabilitation process, just to make sure we're on the same page. but it is a tight balance, and to make sure we're on the same page. Miscommunication with the patient, it's like, oh, the PT said this, but I said this. You know, you want to avoid those at all costs.
Now, do you have any athletic trainers that you work with that help to optimize the surgical outcomes for their patients or their athletes? Or is it mainly they're combining forces with PTs that are also overseeing that rehabilitation protocol?
Yeah, I think that's an important point to, you know, kind of highlight. The PTs help a lot, immensely, obviously, with the rehab process, strengthening, range of motion. But then I do have like my set list of sports-specific athletic trainers. You know, I did Merrimack Division One, you know, for 5 years, hockey players for one. You know, get them back sports-specific hockey, so they're working on more agility, skating drills, you know, those types of things to get them back on the ice at a accelerated pace, I would say, is kind of the goal. So, yeah, there's definitely those unique athletic trainers that push the athlete in that sport-specific manner, which is crucial.
You emphasize communication. You wrote this great paper in maybe a slightly lesser-known journal, but the novel approach to improving patient experience in orthopedics. And the conclusion you came to was patient-physician communication is paramount for enhancing and hopefully ensuring top patient outcomes. So how do you, as a clinician, practice that? And then how do you show that to your mentees and to your fellows and to your residents?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, we've kind of adopted a different kind of model. You know, obviously I take my time with the patient in the room. You know, they communicate through the portal on the EMR. We have Epic, you know, they communicate through there. But the other thing that I found that kind of works, and it's not necessarily me point blank, but the team communication. So my physician assistant's able to do a pre-op telehealth. So they go over everything once again, you know, 2 weeks before the surgery, saying, hey, Dr. Shah's plan is XYZ. The rehab process is, you know, XYZ, partial weight bearing, you know, for X amount of weeks. Here, you know, brace wear. This is optimization. You know, here's some, you know, worry about falling in and out of a, you know, shower, right? Upper extremity, you're going to trip, trying to reach out to grab something. That's where people fall. So those types of things, you know, we kind of reiterate in multiple different ways, not just me saying in the office, but then my PA does in the pre-op telehealth. And then my scheduler sends out pamphlets and packets, you know, pre-op as well. And then I think multiple streams, and then I have videos on my website. So I think multiple streams of communication is how you achieve it.
Do you think providing patients with the maximum amount of information is always the most helpful, or do you find that some come back actually more confused?
There are always going to be those that are come back more confused. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but I'm a big believer in sharing as much information as possible and letting the patient kind of absorb it, you know. And we're I would say lucky to be in an area where the medical literacy is a little bit higher. You know, I have patients coming in, you wouldn't believe the questions they've actually read, watched my videos, watched my lectures, and they come in and they ask, you know, what's the actual metal alloy for the shoulder replacement? You know what I mean? Like questions that you wouldn't expect any patient to ask. So yes, to a certain percentage of patients, maybe it is too much information, and maybe I do talk a lot and talk faster, and maybe it's too much for them to absorb. But if they come back and they say more questions, we just do another telehealth, we talk it over again, you know, kind of iron out all the issues. And again, you know, between me, my PA, my scheduler, there's three different waves and probably three different levels of communication. So I think we've, you know, reduced, that's actually a good study. We probably reduced the amount of phone calls that we receive post-op because of how much we communicate preoperatively.
So let me ask you this. I'm 2.5 years in my career, and I've had the experience a few times where I'll show up to the preoperative area for shoulder surgery and I'll examine the patient. You know, we'll do forward elevation and strength testing, and they'll go 180, and they'll, you know, 5 out of 5 strength. And I said, well, how are you feeling? I said, well, I feel great. And I said, so why are we doing surgery on you? And then we won't end up doing surgery because those patients don't need surgery, and they're very excited. But I'm, you know, then I'll read my clinic notes and say, well, why did we sign this patient up for surgery? Maybe they had, I don't know, moderate glenohumeral arthritis, a little bit of rotator cuff arthropathy, and maybe they had a limited exam or limited pain on that clinic day, but I haven't seen them for 8 weeks. Have you done anything to prevent patients showing up in the pre-op area who have improved on their own? Or do you have any advice in us for our early career physicians who that's happening to?
Yeah, I'll go back to that pre-op telehealth. That's kind of saved those, for lack of a better word, awkward moments. You know, in that pre-op telehealth, you know, my physician assistant will ask them, you know, how they're doing. Are they improved? You know, the main objective for the majority of the surgery we do is pain relief. So they say, you know, they take a, you know, and plus my research coordinator is there. So she takes all the pre-op scores. So she does pre-op VA, you know, visual analog score for pain, pre-op ASES score. So if those scores are like significantly higher than when we saw them at the initial visit, you know, my physician assistant goes over with them and says, hey, like, you know, you're doing kind of too well here. You know what I mean? So that, that does alleviate those types of concerns for sure.
Also to, I guess, piggyback off that question, what role does physical therapy play in those patients that are showing up for that telehealth and the communication between the physical therapist or even the athlete trainer and your PA and yourself? I find that there is less of that communication with newer clinicians coming out versus more seasoned clinicians. Is there something that you would say would be helpful in that same regard to physicians like Dr. Roth or even yourself as far as communication on our end to help you if somebody is improving with PT and was scheduled for surgery? What would that communication be?
Yeah, I think it's more of a, like a trust thing between the PTs and the, you know, the surgeon. Like half of my clinic is like second opinions and it's sent from the physical therapist like, hey, they're not getting better. You know, go see the surgeon to have surgery. But if someone's improving and, you know, God forbid we have them scheduled for surgery, you know, the PT will send me an email. Like, and to be like, hey, you know, they said you're scheduled for surgery, but they're making kind of improvements here. You know, maybe we can chat and I'll, you know, I'll try and schedule the talks back to back. So on my drive home, I can at least call them and, you know, get an update from them and make sure we're all on the same page and kind of doing the right thing by the patient.
Do you find that your second opinion patient visits are mostly talking patients out of surgery or talking patients into a different surgery? Because it may be regional, because in Boston, you're arguably surrounded by the most accomplished and respected orthopedic surgeons in the world. In Arizona, I find all or the majority of my second opinions are talking patients out of surgery. But do you have a different experience at the Baptist?
Yeah, I mean, I get a lot of the complex stuff. So it's a lot of talking patients into different type of surgery. You know, like for a massive rotator cuff or something, you know, there's only a few in the area that do the lower trapezius tendon transfers. Or, you know, maybe we're doing a lat transfer for a massive subscap tear or, you know, something along those lines. That's the vast majority of them. And I'm maybe I'm on the aggressive side, but it's not a lot of, you know, kind of talking out of surgery if they have, because when they come with me, they're coming with imaging, with full thickness tears. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily, you know, just partial thickness tears that are indicated somewhere else that we're trying to talk out of it or something like that.
You talked about lower trap transfers and lat transfers. So obviously shoulder surgery has evolved significantly, even in the past decade since you've been practicing and even in the past 2.5 to 3 years since I've been practicing. What advances in shoulder surgery do you think have had the biggest impact on our patient clinical outcomes?
I mean, the biggest like game changers, you know, LTT, lower trapezius tendon transfers have been like a game changer for me personally. And I'm sure, you know, West also, you know, it's just, and we've actually published this paper, you know, the incidence of shoulder arthroplasty under 50 has gone up 300% in the past 5 years. So we have to find ways to at least buy time, right? We're not necessarily saying that you're saving arthroplasty, but if the initial arthroplasty is at 45, it's not the first revision I'm worried about. I'm worried about the second revision. You know, maybe it's a custom implant at that point, at, you know, 15 plus 15 plus, you know, you get to 70 and you need a $30,000 implant for a surgeon who's not going to do it anyway, you know? So the LTTs for massive cuffs have kind of bought maybe, you know, 7, 8, 10 years, which would then at least elongate that 45 to 55, which is way more reasonable. And then in that paper, we also discussed doing a CAM, you know, a true arthroscopic CAM for, you know, OA patients, intact cuff. And that's been shown, you know, with the Peter Millett data, you know, at least 80% survival at 10 years. So if you can do one of those two things, that has changed the game in terms of, you know, how we can prolong the start of the clock for the arthroplasty. And then you talk about what's the other been the game changer is the technological advances in the reverse is what is, you know, you talk about bigger impact, that might even be bigger impact across the country, just making it more facile and I would say modular so that maybe the community, you know, surgeon who does maybe 10, 15 a year, don't end up being disasters, right? Like the national rates across the country for all these complications are less than 1% across the board. With the modularity, you know, the stability is increased, the implants are better, the screws are better, the fixation is better, you know, all across the board. I think that's been the biggest game changer for sure.
I have so many more questions.
Go for it.
Well, I have a follow-up to that. Actually, it made me think for a second because of the aging population that we see. You said there's a 300% increase in, was it arthroplasty? Is that correct?
Short arthroplasty under 50. That was JSCS we posted 2 years ago.
Is there anything that shows above 50 with the aging population? Because we do deal with a lot of patients that are over 50 or 60 years old that we see in clinic that have had rotator cuff tears, which we're trying to rehabilitate and avoid that surgical procedure. Is there any data that shows that there's an increase in arthroplasty in above 50-year-olds?
Yeah, there definitely is. It's just not as interesting. Like, I didn't pursue that as the research idea because the under 50 population, it was not only increased 300%, but it was increased complication rate. So that's, you want to avoid that. Like under 50, the complication rate went from, you know, cumulative 3 to 4% for over 60 versus under 50, it was 12%, right? Like crazy high comparatively. So, you know, the numbers have gone up across the board in the country, right? Like now shoulder arthroplasty reversed, in fact, you know, eclipsed anatomics 2 years ago as the most popular arthroplasty, you know, over anatomics. I think it was like 5 years ago it eclipsed it. So now but it's still not close to hip and knee, by the way. Hip and knee is still, you know, far and away high volume compared to shoulder. But, you know, the arthroplasty in the country has gone up significantly, yes.
Do you think that's a pendulum that has swung too far in the favor of the reverse? I was listening to Mark Frankel talk, and he's, you know, one of the biggest innovators of the reverse arthroplasty. And it seems like if you get a 75-year-old patient with 130 degrees of active forward flexion, but a little bit of pain, they get a reverse. I mean, you know, some surgeons in Boston who only put in reverses only. Do you think the pendulum may have swung too far and maybe we need to get back to more of a 60-40, 50-50 ratio with an anatomic, or even they have new bearing surfaces where you do a hemiarthroplasty and leave the glenoid alone?
That is an 18-part question, my friend. All right, so one at a time, right? The pendulum swung too far, yes. So I've actually dedicated, we have four papers out, and I'm actually presenting the latest one in Japan in September. So we'll get to that at the end if you want. But we looked at, you know, surgeon decision tree for appropriateness of anatomics. And then at the end of the three-part study, we found that if you follow our surgeon-based algorithm, 92% of patients achieved SCB, not MCID, but two standard deviations above the mean for ASCS for anatomics. So yes, the anatomic, the pendulum has swung too far. The anatomic is not dead, but you have to follow the stringent indications. If you follow our surgeon decision tree, 92% achieve SCB at 2 years, right? And then, so then the fourth one is we're looking at, you know, one of the other companies that I'm a consultant for, they actually have a machine learning model, right? Based on 10 million data points, they can predict your ASCS function, complication rate, and revision rate at 1, 2, 5, and 10 years. So now this latest paper is man versus machine, right? We take the surgeon decision tree versus the machine learning and what are the kind of differences there. So that'll be interesting. We haven't finished that one, so I can't go into that one more, but that I think is going to be super interesting. But the other point that you're making, the 75-year-old, you have to start to also look at the numbers in the country, right? And this is not morbid kind of discussion, but the average life expectancy in America for a male is 78. So if you have a 75-year-old coming in, yes, they're getting a reverse, if they have any sort of cuff tear issues, right? Like if you're a tennis player, if you're a active guy, an MRI proven no cuff tear, then yes, we can discuss anatomics for sure. But you have to take it with a grain of salt because if there's any cuff tear, if there's 130 elevation, not 160, that 130, you're getting a reverse, yes. Because the odds are I can give you a reverse that lasts you at least 10 and you'll be 85. Right? I mean, at 85, unless you're perfect health and you're a tennis player, then we can talk anatomic. Again, I'm open to it. But realistically speaking, 85, cuff tear, 130, you're going to get the best longevity and reliable, predictable functional outcome with the reverse.
So I'm going to nerd out for a second because you mentioned machine learning and my brain started to spin. You talk about predictors and machine learning. Where does AI help us with this in the future with determining outcomes for patients that have maybe an irreparable rotator cuff tear or something along the lines of an anatomical arthroplasty? Like, where is that going to help you as a surgeon on predicting the best for that patient?
So there's three different categories. We don't want to lump them all together, right? There's the visualization, the 3D imaging glasses, right? Then there's the robotics, right? People, you know, kind of conflate those two. And then there's the machine learning AI. I think the machine learning AI is going to help us the most in making decisions and helping us make decisions. The FDA doesn't want you to say making decisions, but helping us make decisions because no human, no matter what, can hold 10 million data points and and make those decisions, right? So that machine learning will help us. And that's where I think the comparison between the surgeon tree and the machine learning is also a good kind of combination. But in shoulder, this may be controversial, but the robot I don't think is going to be a big role. It's just not, right? Like the two that are FDA, we're not going to go in and implant names and whatever, but there's two that are FDA approved. One of them only helps you put the pin in for the central pin, which is important, right? But there's another system that, you know, guides you based on the CT and helps you put in the pin, helps you depth of ream, helps you implant positioning. That's way more useful than just putting in one pin, right? And then the third one, that's the second one that FDA approved, doesn't do any glenoid reaming. So it kind of just sets you up, right? So like, what's the value, the true value other than marketing, other than, you know, kind of patient allure? I don't see the value in robots in the shoulder, unless they're going to tell you, hey, they'll do the ream, like in a uni knee, they do the ream for you. They stop precisely where you're supposed to stop, which is kind of the hardest thing in the uni knee. Unless they do the glenoid reaming for me, I don't see the value for the robot, honestly.
So you're not a fan of the robot, but what emerging techniques or technologies are you excited about?
So I was lucky enough to get the under the hood view. There's one of them coming where the glasses are, it's kind of like, you see the 3D model in your brain, but you can run through different pin placements in that. And then they run the machine learning outcomes based on the base plate positioning of what might have changed based on your off your pre-op plan intraoperatively. So stuff like that, where you can actually change the plan and then see it out, like that Tom Cruise movie, The Minority Report, you know what I mean? Like you can see what's going to happen. That I think is more valuable than necessarily, okay, here's your plan and here is 3D image of your plan. Like you should have that 3D model in your brain, right, for the plan, unless it's actually in real life showing you the plan and where to move your hand to match the plan. I don't think the glasses kind of help you there, no.
Speaking of technology, what are your thoughts on the new wave of rotator cuff augmentation?
So I have three papers out on rotator cuff augmentation, right? So I think it's going that direction. And if you're a surgeon that doesn't believe that, then, you know, maybe time to retire. Because it's going to the point where they're going to have a CPT code for augmentation. Because if they don't, then these ASCs are going to go out of business and, you know, the insurance company is just going to run away with all the money. So it's definitely going that way because all three papers, so there's three categories of augmentation. There's Mayer stimulation, there's injectables, and then there's patch augmentation on top, right? We're not talking about a gap. We're not talking about LTT or supercapsular reconstruction. We're talking about augmentation of the repair with the patch. All three have shown to lower retail rates. So if the insurance companies actually care about patient outcomes, if the surgeon center actually care about patient outcomes, it's going to be augmentation. And, you know, the ROE score, you know, healing index, that plays a huge role. You know, obviously we have to be cost conscious, but in most of these patients, let's be honest, if they're over 65, have one of these diabetes, you know, two tendon tear, these kind of risk factors that are at risk for not healing. Even some of the ones that are under 65 have these, you know, diabetes, former smoker, two tendon tear. These are all risk factors for, you know, and you look at the ROHI score strictly, you're looking at 12 to 25% healing rates, which are not good. You know what I mean?
It sounds like you maybe a little bit more, I don't want to say aggressive, but you like to use the patch augmentation more. And obviously the literature bears it out. Is there a ROHI score? Do you have a minimum threshold for ROHI score for patch augmentation?
Yeah, 45%, right? Like once you tip over the majority, that's kind of, you know, nudging you in that direction to use it. And I've kind of, you know, gone back and forth. You have to keep in mind what you're dealing with. If it's, you know, diabetes, poor tissue, you're kind of leaning towards the kind of scaffold augment versus if you're, you know, kind of a larger tail, two tendon tear, maybe you need more structure, maybe you're leaning towards the structural augments, right? There's different variations on which augments you're going to use. And, you know, I've gone back and forth. That's why we have the data for all three, because it's a variant of what you're going to put in. If it's a better bone patient with maybe a male, you know, under 60, then maybe I'm doing Mayer stimulation, because then you can afford that, because that bone is just so much better. You don't need to put in, you know, kind of exogenous, you know, pig mucosa tissue. You know what I mean? So you want to avoid it if you can. I'm a big believer based on the data. It's not just my belief. It's based on the data for the improved healing rates and lower retail rates with the augmentation.
Now there's one thing that we see a lot of, and it's, you know, we see a lot of athletes in our clinics, whether it be recreational athletes, play tennis, pickleball is a big one now, we're seeing a lot of injury. What are the biggest differences between treating elite athletes or athletes in general and the general population?
So I would answer that in two ways. The first is they want to get back so bad that some of the ones that you're like, it wasn't, you know, like maybe I could have done an extra anchor or an extra something. They kind of make you look good because they want to get back so well that they rehab it. And, you know, their bodies are just different, right? Like a D1 athlete versus me is just different. So their healing potential is going to be better because they're just built biologically better, right? And then the other thing I would say, the other side, flip side of that is the demand is higher, right? So, you know, they want, and they're on board with it. They want everything fixed. They want every path out there into their health, maybe more than the 50-year-old recreational athlete. They want to know exactly what's going on, every kind of update that they're into it. So it's more exciting because then they're as much into it as you are, you know, like that's kind of rare sometimes. So it's fun that way when they're like kind of into it and high-fiving you as excited as you are, you know what I mean? Nerding out with it.
Now, do you have that conversation with that person that is looking and seeing these professional athletes that are coming back faster than typical you, me, or Dr. Roth? Do you have that conversation with them that biological healing is biological healing and you got to kind of stick to the protocol and listen to your therapist? What's the conversation on follow-up post-surgery with you?
Yeah, and I feel like you guys did your homework. These are all my papers, right? So we published the Division I collegiate, and that was kind of the ones we wanted to point out was not just professional, right? Like it's common, you know, more commonsensical to think like professional is not the same as me, but like, you know, I did, you know, Brandeis and other kind of, you know, Division II, Division III schools, and they think, okay, this D1, you know, Ohio State guy got back to, you know, 10 months post ACL, I can do the same. And we published that paper. It's just not, right? Division I versus Division II and Division III, it's not equivalent in terms of return to play rates and times. And then the other paper that actually won Best Systematic Review of the Year in Arthroscopy Journal, we have set out minimums, right? So minimum 10 months for return to sport, and you have to pass two of the functional tests. If you do those three things, right, 10 months, minimum 10 months, and two out of the three, two functional tests, your retail rates drop three times. So, you know, I use that clinical data to show them, right, from the jump, you have to pass. It's not just, oh, Dr. Shaw thinks it's been great, and then you go back. You have to pass objective criteria to go back, and then your retail rates drop significantly. And most of the athletes are able to buy in and understand that because it is objective data.
So in the same vein of us doing our homework and talking about patient outcomes, can you talk to us a little bit about how social determinants of health influence clinical outcomes of patients who are undergoing rotator cuff repair? So ethnicity, socioeconomic status, comorbidities, et cetera. And how do we as physicians try our best to treat everyone equally?
Yeah, that's another kind of passion of mine. You know, I'm part of the J. Robert Glavin Society, which is the Minority Orthopedic Surgeon Society. They gave us a kind of a grant to do that study. It was two separate studies. One rotator cuff was in JSES, and we had two more for shoulder arthroplasty, like two different projects, I mean. But the one for shoulder arthroplasty I'll focus on because that had the more meaningful data and more easily readable data, I will say. It was a higher rate of humeral fracture and dislocation in patients who are from a higher deprived state, meaning not just, you know, race necessarily or even socioeconomic status necessarily. It was, is there someone at home that can drive you to PT? Is the, or help you with the sling, right? Like, do you have a car at home or do you have to get in an Uber or a Lyft or public transportation, right? Like all these things people don't realize, you may fall down the bus stairs. You may, you know, you may dislocate, you know, putting on the sling back on or putting your shirt back on because there's no one there to help you at home. Those types of things I think are being underrated. And you asked about how you can incorporate that into the office. We actually published another study looking at different factors in the EMR that you can pull out to predict which ones are higher risk. And that was actually, it was higher area under the curve, meaning like predictability of outcomes, better than ASA, the anesthesia score. So it was like history of blood transfusion or, you know, those types of things actually correlated better than the ASA score for predicting, you know, complications.
How are you screening your patients on a daily basis?
That's my research coordinator helping on the back end, collecting all that data. I'm not capable of doing, I pay attention to most everything, but I can't do 100%. So she's there, you know, she collects the pre-op ASES, VAS score, all these, you know, history of blood transfusion, history of cancer, all these kind of other predictors that we have that, and she does a great job of putting that together for sure.
So for patients with a higher deprivation index, how do we reduce the number of complications that they have postoperatively?
That's an excellent question. You know, what we're trying, you know, we haven't had enough data to be able to publish whether it's working or not, but how we're trying is my research coordinator through Epic is able to collect all the social determinants of health. We put it into the model, and then we can determine whether they're at high risk, medium risk, or low risk. And then the ones that are high risk are the ones that we, you know, maybe have two pre-op telehealths, or we have an, like additional paperwork that we sent them, or, you know, stuff along those lines to kind of pay a little bit more attention to those people that we know that are higher risk, but haven't been able to quantify that whether that actually makes a true clinical difference. My hope is that it does, you know, but it's just something that we just have to continue to strive to get better at.
Thoughts on balloon spacer for massive irreparable rotator cuff tear?
How much time do we have? That is almost, you know, I don't never say never in medicine, and you know, you don't want to go too far on either end, but orthopedic data is not the best the vast majority of the time, except in this case. We have like a randomized control trial that shows there's no real benefit to the balloon in terms of versus a partial repair in good studies that were published in large, you know, impact factor journals. So, you know, my stance on it is if you need a balloon and you're in that much pain and you have poor function, you get a lower trap. And the argument on the other side is, oh, they're trying to save the reverse in a 7-year-old with a massive cuff. But then if they have good function and it's just pain, you know, how bad is the pain? And is the balloon going to help the pain? I'm not convinced the balloon theoretically will help you with function. Right. So, you know, there's better options, I think, on either side of it. Young massive cuff gets an LTT versus old massive cuff, probably looking at a reverse anyway. Well, and the cost of it too, right? The cost is insane. So, you know, how do you justify that is I would say a null sum game.
Agreed.
I have one more question for the sake of time. And then we have a rapid fire that we do at the end.
Let's do it. Yeah,
these
yeah.
One hitters. So many of our listeners are athletic trainers, PTs, residents, fellows. What advice would you give them if they wanted to get into a leadership role in sports medicine?
Excellent question. And I tell it to all my fellows every day. This is not Walmart. This is not a clock in, clock out job. We are taking care of people. If you want to be the best that you can be, you got to put in the effort and the time. And it's not just showing up. It's not just caring in the room. If you care about the patient, go home and read. You go home and read. You be the most knowledgeable, most independent, hone your skills, go to all the labs that are offered, hone your skills to be the best surgeon, best physician, best scientist you can be. And that's how you take the best care of your patients.
That's an amazing answer. And I'm going to replay that in all of the reviews I do for all my PTs.
Well, because that's how you get in leadership roles, right? Everyone sees that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, no one will question your, you know, value or what you bring to the table if you're showing everyone else without even saying it, the hard work you're putting in and the knowledge that you have by demonstrating that, it does permeate and people see that. And in my opinion, that's how I would lead. It's lead by example.
And you know, it's a fantastic answer because we talk about this quite often in my world in physical therapy and athletic training. And all of the students or clinical students or staff therapists that come up, I always tell them, you know, you have to put in the extra time. Again, it's not a 7-to-3 or a 9-to-5 job. You have to put the effort in. And if you want to get to know the surgeons and the other therapists and the other scientists in the region, you have to go out and knock on the doors and make yourself available. And you got to do the work for the patient because that's what we're in it for. And if we're not doing it, then you're not doing your job as a clinician. But also to get to the next level, you have to be able to provide that type of, you know, ability to be make yourself available. So that was fantastic.
All right, you ready for the lightning round?
Let's go for it.
What's the procedure that you do that you think works the best? So makes the biggest difference in patient clinical outcome?
So I'll give you two answers. One and number one and number two. Number one is my favorite of all time, Bankart Remplissage. It is the most satisfying. You take that pre-op picture where they're sitting out the front and get that last picture, you know, so three in the front typically for me, Bankart, two Remplissage in the back. And you see that centered head and that 18, 20-year-old is back to collision sports and like living their life of happiness, which I am no longer able to do at 38 years old. It's like the best feeling in the world. And number two is MPFL, you know, TTO, MPFL, patellar instability. You give them back their freedom, mobility, you know, and I'm pretty aggressive on cartilage repair also. MACI is my preferred treatment in that modality. And it's a long haul, but it's also a big gain. And they're most of my patients who get these, you know, kind of TTO, MPFL, MACIs, they're in their 20s. I mean, we're not doing this in 55-year-olds, but, you know, they're in their 20s and 30s and they're back to their daily life. And they come in at that 8-week, 10-week mark, give you that big hug, like, hey, I can run again. I can, you know what I mean? Like I can swim again. I can do my sporting activities. That's the favorite. That's how it makes everything worth it, right? Is what you were talking about, you know, why you put in the time. That's what makes it worth it.
One surgical intervention that changed your practice.
LTT, lower trap, you know, because I watched one in fellowship, right? It's not like it was popular when I did my shoulder elbow fellowship even. But it's fun to learn. It's the anatomy's fun and it's very tedious in terms of number of steps to do. and you can kind of screw up any single one and it ruins the whole thing. So in that sense, a little stressful, tedious, but has changed my practice in terms of giving me that medium ground. You know, what can I do in that tweener 53-year-old with a massive cuff that I don't want to put a reverse in? What can I do? This has been a game changer, right? And we're in the process of collecting that data, comparing the ones from my surrounding practice area who end up doing maybe did either a revision repair or reverse versus LTT at 2 years. And you know, revision rates, complications, all that kind of stuff. So it's comparable to the reverse is kind of the bottom line at the midterm. So 3 to 5 year mark, we'll see long-term. Obviously, I don't think that's going to hold up, but at least if you can buy them 5 to 10 years, it's kind of a win.
Research question in sports medicine that you wish you had the answer to right now.
Cartilage repair. Right, like we've like talked about this over and over and over again, and I've written papers, and you know, like I've read all the papers about depth of penetration, microdrilling is coming, making a renaissance return, you know, all the biologics, augmentation. You know, one of the best kind of augmentation for microdrilling merostimulation papers is this hyaluronic acid based scaffold, or injectables. There's this like Iron Legend type stuff where they using a virus, they virally transduced the chondrogenesis, you know, TGF-beta gene into chondrocytes, into chondrocytes, where they're like essentially making them higher impact chondrocytes and injecting them back into the knee. It's called INVASA, TGF-beta injected chondrocytes. And it's increased tibial thickness of cartilage at 2 years. So that's still only phase 3 trials in the FDA, but like it's all coming, hopefully, maybe, but nothing is like clinical to show it more than 2 years.
Best advice a mentor has given you?
Best advice? I would say, don't say no. You know, people always say like, oh, you know, don't bite too much off. And, you know, you can only handle too much. We're all type A people, right? If you go into orthopedics, we all want to do more. So if you just say yes to everything and then you'll figure it out. Open so many more doors.
I love it. Something outside of medicine that helps you stay balanced?
My wife.
Great answer.
She, you know, I love my wife, and you know, she's been, you know, obviously support, but she kind of holds you accountable, I think is the best way to put it. You know, when I'm running a mile a minute, or, you know, I'm talking a mile a minute, she's like, just take a breath, you know, and that, it helps. It helps.
So if we brought you back in 10 years from now, what would you hope has changed in sports medicine, both clinically and socially?
That's a good question. What I hope would have changed, because I'm on both sides of the pendulum or world, if you will. I want more collegiality between sports medicine and shoulder elbow. You're not enemies, you know, which is what they're viewed as, you know, and even a step further, maybe even combine, you know, ANA and AOSSM. There doesn't need to be two societies, you know, for ANA anymore versus AOSSM. And that way you can combine resources even. And then we have our own pack, ortho pack for sports medicine that can maybe get their augmentation CPT code. You know what I mean? Stuff like that, I think would be better socially and better, you know, kind of functionality between us collegially between the surgeons.
That's great.
To open up a little bit more controversy, you did a sports medicine fellowship.
Yes.
Why did you do a subsequent shoulder elbow fellowship? Do you think after a sports medicine fellowship, you need an additional shoulder elbow fellowship? And then what do you think of full upper extremity fellowships?
So that's an excellent question. And I've even said this to people, the interviewees that ask me that question in the interview room. I've said to them, I'm a big believer in the two fellowship. And depends on where you do it, obviously. If you're doing a sports fellowship, you should be able to do, I would say, a more straightforward, let's say reverse, right? If it's a massive cuff or OA kind of patient, you should be able to do that. But there's a big difference between, like, I don't say no to anything in the shoulder. I did 27 revisions last year, right? Like, not mine, but like I get everybody's revisions because I did 800 replacements my HSS year in fellowship. Like, it's just a different level of confidence and skill level that you can't possibly get in 1 year. Whether you do shoulder elbow 1 year or sports med 1 year, you can't. And then if you do shoulder elbow 1 year, you can't get that sports experience, right? Like my Baptist sports fellowship, I did count, I'd have to look up how many, but probably 300 rotator cuff repairs. You know what I mean? Like, the scope skills are just completely different on the sports side, and the arthroplasty skills are completely different on the shoulder level side.
Great answer. Not as controversial as I thought. That's a great answer.
Well, it's controversial because to the fellows, right? Like, you have to justify it to your family for putting in the time of being, you know, essentially another, you know, minion for another year making minimum wage, right? Like, you're never going to get that money back, but you're investing in yourself to take better care of patients so you'll be able to sleep better. That's how I phrase it. It's not financially ROI. It's peace of mind ROI.
That's a good answer. I love it.
That's awesome.
Well, Dr. Shah, thank you for coming on the podcast today. We truly appreciate your insight and what you do every day. And hopefully we continue the conversation at a later date. It was great.
Appreciate it. I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.